Good morning, folks. Before we get started, we would like to remind everybody, please do turn off or silence your cell phones, and please be aware that texting during the meeting is kind of, it's appreciated if we don't, because it's kind of distracting as I turn off my cell phone. And also, please be aware that there are folks who are really sensitive to fragrances, soaps and perfumes and things like this. There are people who have real reactions who come here a lot. So we're going to ask, if you're wearing something today, that's okay. Please stay. But in the future, if you'd bear that in mind, that would be help. And then finally, for Sunday, March 19th, there was a change made to the periodical. And so if you have a periodical from earlier or from a previous month, why don't you grab a new one, because the correction was made. And that correction simply is, on March 19th, is William Q. Judge Day, which is something we recognize every year on March, you know, around March 19th. Okay. So, welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists. We'll begin our meeting simply with a reading of the Declaration of the Lodge. Kind of tells us who we are, what it's for, what the purpose of the Lodge is. And also, it's the only simple statement that is the guiding document for all of the lodges around the world, of which there are about 25. It's not a big complicated structural organization. We are an association of students of the philosophy of theosophy, and we come together based on principle, on applying the principles in our lives. So, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now, to carry out the purposes of the lodge, we here in Philadelphia conduct meetings on a weekly basis, twice a week. On a Wednesday evening, actually the lodge opens at, 5:15?
Yes.
Thank you. And we open at 5:15 because we have a public reference library at the front of the lodge where you'll find straight-line theosophical literature, directly reproduced facsimiles from the original writings, as well as articles written by seniors, by students who have been cross-checked, cross-referenced to maintain their integrity and consistency with the philosophy. Also, that's from 5:15 to 7:15. Also here in the lodge, we have a book table if you want to do study at home. The books that we make available are sold at cost. There's no profit in what we do. But also, speak with the person at the book table. If you prefer to go online, it's all available for free online. So that's Wednesday afternoon. And Wednesday evening we have a study course. We're currently studying a book called The Key to Theosophy by H.B. Blavatsky. And this is going on from 7:30 to 8:30 every evening. It's carried on very simply by, really there's a presentation, a summary of the part each week, and then there's plenty of time for questions and answers and investigation into the ideas of the philosophy. Then on Sundays, of course, we have our Sunday morning meetings from 11 to 12 noon, and the doors open at 10:30. Our meetings are open to the public. Our meetings are free to all. Any donations are certainly welcome, but the point being that all of what we do, the ideas that we present, our effort is to keep these ancient ideas before the public and free, without respect to, you know, anyone who wants to donate in terms of personal effort, personal time, money, and service. Everything's, you know, we receive it gratefully, but there is no obligation, there's no dues, there's no fees. So without further ado, Sundays during the month of March. Well, we've been studying in January. It has been the path of spiritual evolution. And that was followed in February, Sundays, by developing moral qualities that reform human nature. And now we're to a point here in March, the Sunday talks all fall under the umbrella topic of mental progress. And today's talk is developing intellect and intuition. So there'll be a presentation on intellect and then on intuition, and after which the rest of the hour will be spent in talk and discussion. So one thing that's helpful to remember as one studies the philosophy of theosophy is, first of all, there's a language that is used, sometimes unfamiliar words, and you might hear, when we talk about the mind, you might hear the word manas, which is a Sanskrit word, which simply translates into mind. And it may also be helpful to realize that the idea that manas, mind, when we are incarnated as human beings, has a dual nature. When we're not incarnated, it is part of our immortal spiritual nature. When we're incarnated, it takes on a personal nature and at the same time a dual nature. So sometimes you'll hear the words lower mind and higher mind. Well, it's not that we have two minds. It's that there are different functions. So whenever we hear the lower mind, we're talking about the lower function of the mind or the higher function of the mind. But the mind is, we can say it is the thinker. It is the immortal thinker. It is the power to think. So let's try to grasp what we're talking about when it comes to development of intellect. To grasp that, we have to have an idea of really what mind is all about and the purpose of mind. Because real knowledge of the mind cannot be obtained from books. We can read about what the mind is from something that somebody else wrote. But to really get to gain knowledge of our own mind takes observation and experience. It has to be recognized, and true perception of the nature of our own mind must be realized by each one within himself. In the highest sense, mind is said to be the very power to think, the very power to express intelligence. Of whatever degree, it could be refined or coarse or whatever grade of life in the universe, visible or invisible, the power to think is the power of the mind in its highest sense. During incarnation, the nature of the mind is dual, as we said. How much more do we know about our mind other than that aspect of our mind which is under the influence of external circumstances, under the influence of, you know, the objects of our desires? How much more is there to our mind other than that part of it that we know? Well, there are those who have known of the nature of the twofold nature of manas or of mind, and ancient scriptures have written about it. In fact, when one studies the Sermon on the Mount, it puts the Sermon on the Mount into a completely different light and more comprehensible when we read it in the nature of there is a twofold nature to mind. Also, the Bhagavad Gita. This is a story that represents the action of mind during this period of evolution, which presents a great war that's going on between the intuitive thinker within and what we would say the lower, selfish, separative powers of the mind, which creates the identity of the self. So everybody has that inner jihad, the higher and the lower, the higher trying to tame, control, influence the lower in the interest to be of greater service to all. So one has to endure and overcome the tendencies of the lower sense mind. The lower sense mind tends to gravitate, take shape of, and identify itself as the external objects of perception. The things that we sense is what the lower mind is attracted to and takes the form of and identifies itself as. The idea then is to restore the higher thinking principle, the immortal ego, as lord over the self, to restore. It's kind of like putting the sun back into the center of the solar system. If each of us is an individualized solar system, let everything revolve around the higher mind. That's the way we're built, unless we change it through false ideas. So our mind has a dual nature, a deceptive nature when it's involved in the senses of perception and accepts the objects of perception as what's real out there. But then there's what we call the unmoved thinker. The unmoved thinker who has a full realization of his unchanging self. And if he does have a full realization of his unchanging self, really it could be said he has a full realization of the unchanging self, the one. And this in the midst of an infinitude of endlessly changing cycles of exterior worlds. The fact is, though, we need the lower mind. It's important to have the lower mind because it's the means by which the higher mind interacts with this plane, with this manifested plane. The lower mind is the intellect. That's what we say about that's what we mean by the lower mind. It is the intellect, as opposed to the intuition. It's the power to interpret sensations. It's the power to evaluate impressions. It's the power to read a good book. It's even the power to smell smoke and decide to take certain action if the smoke is out of place. We need our lower mind. Also, the lower mind has the power to reason. It's the lower mind that reasons from premise to conclusion. It's the lower mind that says, if this, then that. Movement is an aspect of the lower mind. The unmovable thinker is the higher. Movement per se is an aspect of the lower mind. In fact, if we've ever considered the idea of absolute abstract movement, perhaps the nature of the lower mind is a good analogy for what absolute abstract movement can be, because it's always thinking. That's the nature of mind. The unmoved thinker within, then, has the duty, the higher nature has the duty to govern the actions or the movement of the lower mind. Without the governance of the higher mind, the lower mind is influenced by something else besides the higher principles. So the lower mind has these tendencies. We all know, you know, we can be focused on one thing and boom, suddenly we're thinking of something else. It flies off to a good subject or a negative thing that sometimes we'll be consumed about in particular today. It also, there's also the idea that the lower mind, if it's passive for too long, this can be a tendency toward insanity. And insanity, think theosophically speaking, is a separation of the mind from the instrument it uses, the brain. The natural motion of the mind can be trained. It can be trained to recall ideas by using reflection. It can be trained to anticipate ideas by thinking proactively. It can be, and actually is, it can be used as a microcosm of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. It's the mind that builds, maintains, and destroys. The mind, it is the power of the lower mind to establish persistent connections between ideas. This is a power of the lower mind. By establishing persistent connections between ideas and impressions, and among ideas and impressions, that's what we use from day to day. When we wake up in the morning, it's our lower mind that we use to recognize that I still am the same me that I was yesterday. So the idea of who we are, this I am, comes about because of the powers of the lower mind. Now remember, it's the lower mind that reasons from premise to conclusion. So when we ask ourselves, who am I? I know who I am. Really, do we know who we are? It depends on the ideas that the lower mind considers to be true. Because who we think we are, or what we think we are, may actually be very different from truly who we are. So then, the highest function of the lower mind then is to recognize the idea that it is the creator of our perception of the self. The highest function of the lower mind, when it recognizes that, is to disperse of the idea of the personal self. If we base our ideas of self on false ideas that I am this body and I am I, then suddenly I'm me and you are you and you're not me and we're separate. It takes the power of the higher mind to shed light, the reality of light and intuition, on the deficiencies of lower mind if it's operating just according to its own lower purposes. And if the mind of man, we're told, through false ideas and erring intellect, is lost in his own personal desires without the light of higher mind, if he's just lost in his own stuff, then the thinker becomes purely intellectual and loses his intuition. He becomes purely intellectual and his entire nature tends downward.
Now we move to the idea of developing the intuition, and it occurs to us that we're at a disadvantage because we have to use our reason initially to understand that intuitive process. But that's where we begin, to begin to identify and clarify the ideas we're speaking of. So we want to address the idea first is, what is the intuition? And we're going to discuss it from three points of view. We're going to say that intuition is not only a power or faculty of mind, but it is also knowledge, and it is also an inner sense, a spiritual sense, if you will, as distinguished from our outer physical senses. And we'll get more into that. So when we say intuition is a power or faculty, what is it actually knowing? Intuition is the direct power to know the truth in all things. And so when we say the truth, truth is that which is endures, is universal, is the same regardless of the relative conditions of the world or ourselves. It's something that's enduring. It's the true nature of a thing, an object, an idea, an action. And intuition is the power of mind to know directly the truth, the real inner nature, internal nature of anything. And if we have that power of mind, then there must be some aspect of our mind that is all-knowing, omniscient, if you will. And that is our higher mind, as distinguished from the lower mind, which has the same power, but its use, as said, is influenced by the faculties of our brain and body, which determine its range of knowing. So intuition, then, as a power, is instantaneous. Now, we know we have to analyze, and sometimes we have to figure out things and reason things and study things for hours and days and years, and all of a sudden it comes to us, and we just know. It becomes of our intuitive knowledge, and it's instantaneous. So we walk into a room of people that we've never met, and we can shake hands and talk to a few people in the room, and within a very few seconds, perhaps less than a minute, we know instantaneously the attraction, whether we just have an inner feeling of the reality of this situation. We're going to get more into that. But it is instantaneous. It's also unerring. It's instinctive. Now, there is an instinctive quality in the animal kingdom that is unerring. And if it was not for this instinctive knowledge of animals, they would not be able to survive in this world. And we have an unerring quality, an instinctive way. It can come through our feelings very often, or it sometimes comes through our physical nature. We say we have a gut feeling, or the hairs on the back of our neck stand up on edge, or we get a prickly feeling of the skin. But our body seems to react unerringly to a certain situation. Very often it's later seen to be a dangerous situation. So that is intuition as knowing. But we said it is also knowledge. And in a sense, it is knowledge of our past experience, but not just the past experience of this life. It is a teaching of theosophy that the thinker, the real immortal being, or the real inner being, we call the human being, is an entity, a spiritual entity that existed before the body, certainly uses the body, but endures after the body. In fact, it is the mind being that incarnates life after life, accumulating the lessons and experiences of those various existences on this physical plane. And so we have stored in our higher mind the experiences of all that previous knowledge. And intuition is sort of like a direct tap into that accumulated wisdom of all of our experiences. And there is kind of that reflected in the lower mind. Psychologists know that in the mind, and some certain techniques of therapy and certainly hypnosis, previous experiences that seem to be unconscious to us or subconscious to us are actually stored into the mind and under certain circumstances can be brought to our conscious recognition. But even though we're not aware of them consciously, they can continue to act on us as impressions. So it is a knowledge, then, we said, of the real nature of all things. And it comes through the identification, this knowledge comes through the identification of the mind with the object to consider. So in a very practical way, if we want to understand biology, we have to focus our mind and identify with it and use the powers of the lower mind to study, and eventually that knowledge becomes ours. And likewise, if we want to tap into that accumulated wisdom or knowledge in our higher nature, the mind, our lower mind, has to begin to identify with something higher, or the higher aspect. And as we do that, we attract to ourselves the inherent wisdom there. This will be discussed more, and it's actually the, in a more complete sense, going to be discussed at the end of the month when we get into the subject more deeply of retrieving soul memories. So we said mind is a power, it is a knowledge, but it is also an inner sense. So how do our outer senses work? Well, our outer senses focus on the physical world, and the vibrations are transmitted back to the brain, and the mind perceives them as an idea. And so we sense this to be solid. This table is solid. Why? Because our eyes transmit certain information through our senses and we form an idea. But this table is not really solid, and science knows this. It is really a more vibration and motion of particles that are moving so fast that to our physical senses we can't discern that, but other instruments can. And so the reality of this table, it's more motion and space and whirling of atoms and molecules than it is solid. But that's how our senses. Our inner senses, though, work, we might say, from within outward. They perceive things that are real on the inner planes and transmit them to our minds and to our awareness from within. So we know in a much more reliable way, in a much quicker way. So we know intuitively because we sense or feel things that come to us through our inner awareness that our reason, our senses, may not be able to see. So somebody said, well, how do you know that? I just know. I mean, I don't have to reason it out. It's real, it's true. And it turns out, in most cases, to be reliable. So we said it's power. So then is it present in all human beings? It is a faculty of mind, and so a human being is born with this faculty, and it is present there all the time. It is active in the innermost part of our nature all the time. So how do we experience it? Well, we said it comes through us in a variety of ways. For many of us, it's just, if it comes through the feelings, in meeting certain situations, it may be a feeling of, I just know this is right for me, or this is wrong for me, I need to stay away. It comes through the feeling nature, or it comes through as a gut feeling, we say. But it also comes through, for many of us, as the voice of conscience. And in this case, it's our past memory coming through our nature and telling us, in a sense, that there's some danger here. Watch out. So how does that work? Well, if we've walked in to our bedroom, let's say, 1,000 times, we've sort of surveyed that area. We have within us a certain inner map of what that room should look like. And if one day we come into the room and things are out of place where they shouldn't be, we say an alarm bell goes off. Something's wrong here. It's that instantaneous, unerring recognition that something's out of place, and it could be a dangerous. Watch out. And so the same thing happens with our voice of conscience. We have a storehouse of memory of situations from our accumulated experience. We approach something, and if it's out of context, if there's something, we get an inner sense, a realization from within, there's something wrong here, or avoid doing that. So this is a common way in which intuition works through us all. And there's also what we call that voice of the silence. The various devotional books speak of it in Eastern and Western religions. But it's what we might call our inner spiritual wisdom, our knowledge of things. And so we may not we may come to a certain field, and we just find, compared to the other people in the room, that we just have a more direct feeling of understanding, whether it's mathematics or art or psychology or philosophy or a certain religion. We just intuitively know more about it than the other people. Now, they may know more things than us in other areas, but we carry with us intuitively a certain talent, a genius, an intuitive wisdom from our past. And that is, it's a direct knowledge of things. And that is something that the more we study ourselves and others, we realize we all have. So then the third question to be considered is, really gets to the heart of the subject, is can it be developed? So since it is a faculty of mind, and we all have minds, and it is always acting within us, can it be developed? Can it be developed to a higher degree? And it can be developed by anyone and everyone, but frankly, it's rare that an individual pursues that or has the knowledge to know how to do it. And here in Theosophy, we have a lot about how to do it and how each one can do it, because in a way, Theosophy comes to us from those who know, those who have developed their highest faculties, not just their senses and their intellect, but their intuitive spiritual faculties to the highest possible degree. And so they can see things and know things and check things out that for most of us, we don't know because we rely on our senses and personal experience. But having traveled that path, they can tell us the way we can begin to develop those higher faculties for ourselves and how we can begin to check, test, and verify as we develop those faculties, intellectual or intuitional, so that we may have this knowledge for ourselves and not depend just on what somebody else says. So we have to realize that our intuitions are not infallible where we are, because it's a developing faculty. It can be developed to the point where it is all-knowing, omniscient in that sense, but where we are, it's infallible. And it's infallible, it's not infallible, excuse me. It's infallible because its intuition comes through, or the higher mind comes through, those memories, those impressions. It's colored by the impressions we have from our senses, from our ideas, from our passions. And so those things can give it a certain tendency we did not originally have. So if we think of our mind as a prism made up of the ideas, thoughts, and feelings and memories we have, as the light, as the white light of intuition or truth comes through, it's broken up into a rainbow of colorations. And depending on how that prism or that mind is constructed, so will be the distortions. And so our intuitive ideas or feelings about people or things, we need to check, test, and verify them with our reason. And even though intuition is superior to reason, it knows directly, we at our stage need reason in order to check and develop our intuitions. And so how do we do this? Well, we have some universal fundamental principles that we study in the philosophy. Philosophical ideas that are not just true in this time or this place among that person, but they are truths, universal truths, because they can be shown to be applicable and in all sorts of situations and have been known and checked, tested, and verified down through the ages, expressed in many different ways. And so if we get an intuition which is supposed to be true and universal and spiritual, then it should dovetail with what we study philosophically. And also, we need to be able to understand ourselves. Now, I have a little bit of self-knowledge. You know, there's a book written, The Ego is the Enemy, meaning ego in the inflated idea. We think we're too much of ourselves, and some people even see signs and bumper stickers people put to remind themselves, the ego is your enemy. And what basically we mean by that is the inflated personal ideas of who we think we are and what we think we are and the way we might tend to think ourselves better or lesser than somebody else because of our ideas of who we are as persons gets in the way. And so we need to be able to filter out what's coming from that egotism and what's coming from what's truly spiritual. And so the more we compare our own ideas with the ideas of sages and around the world who are recognized for the wisdom, that's one way of discerning that. And so we need to get out, we need to clear away some of our misconceptions. So reason, intellect, is helpful developing intuition, but it can't just be done by that. We need to apply it. We need to add philosophy to ethics or altruism. We need to walk the talk, put into practice the ideas we learn. Altruism in thought, word, and deed. And that begins to clear up the various sheaths of our nature, the sensory, the intellectual, the ideas, the thoughts, the feelings. As we begin to act according to a certain ideal, it purifies that nature, it purifies the prism, so those ideas come through undistorted. Intuition is also developed through experience and observation, and as was said before, we need to begin with the observation that we are more than this personal mind, this mind that thinks and identifies with conditions. We need to realize that we are thinkers, that there's something in us that hasn't changed throughout all the changes of our personality and who we think we are. And that is our power to know, to perceive, to think. We had it when we were children. We had it when we were teenagers. It is the same thinking identity that we are now. Now, the ideas we hold change. The things we think about change. But we all are that enduring power to think. That is our higher mind. The more we think from that nature, the more we act from that nature and interact from that nature, the more the intuition is developed. So in one of the devotional books, it says, spiritual knowledge awakes in one who lives the life. In other words, to begin to live as that one self in each and all. So there is much more that could be said about both these topics, but we'll address your particular questions and comments on this very interesting subject.
In the back.
The words accumulated wisdom were used in describing intuition. What is that accumulated wisdom? Where does it come from? And how do we attain it?
The accumulated, we can speak of accumulated wisdom in various ways. There is the accumulated wisdom of the ego or the incarnating mind being from one life to the next. We know that we may not remember all the experiences we've gone through in the years of our lives, but there is a certain accumulated wisdom that we have now at our exposure as the result of that experience. Well, multiply that, magnify that by many lives. Then we must realize we have an accumulated wisdom. Now, not that well, that is accessible to us, but that's understandable. We can't necessarily consciously recall all the things, all the lessons we learned in this life. Or maybe we don't even remember what we ate 2 weeks ago. But it is there. It's recorded in our inner nature, and it can be brought out to awareness by certain techniques. So that's one aspect. But then there's also the accumulated wisdom of the ages. Human beings that have checked, tested, and verified certain ideas and facts and laws regarding nature and have written it down. It's recorded in symbols, in glyphs, in legends, in myths and stories throughout the world. And so we can have access to that accumulated wisdom in that sense through study, through the use of our reason and intellect. Well, they're just two aspects, perhaps some other ideas.
Yes?
In regards to intuition, we hear all the time, too, that Bodhi is the storehouse of intuition. So what is the difference, then, between Bodhi as intuition and higher mind as intuition?
So the question is, what's the difference between, when we're considering intuition, what's the difference between Bodhi as intuition and higher mind as intuition? Well, if we look at mind per se, when we talk about the incarnation of man, each incarnation that he goes through, the aspect of man that incarnates is the mind, and we could say is kind of anchored into our desires. So the mind can be, the lower mind can be influenced by the desires or can influence the desires. If we don't take control over our desires may well take control over us. On the other hand, the higher mind will turn to the light of Bodhi, and Bodhi simply is our spiritual soul. It's the very vehicle that serves, it serves as the vehicle of spirit within our highest nature. It's there where all of our highest aspirations and experiences are assimilated to. Not everything that we experience is assimilated into Bodhi. It's only assimilated if it's worthy of being there. If it, you know, is we'll leave it at that. So Bodhi, this of course is like an analogy or an expression. When we turn toward Bodhi, toward the light of the higher mind, we're turning toward the universal ideas, which everyone has access to. It's just a matter of, have we done the work within to reach that wisdom? And so we'll leave it at that.
So it was previously said that it is the thinker or the ego that reincarnates, but the ego in fact is more than mind. It's a three-in-one, it's a trinity. In Sanskrit the words are atma, buddhi, manas. In English it's spirit, spiritual soul, and mind. And we can think of spirit as the power to know or to be aware. We can think of soul or spiritual soul as the accumulated awareness or experiences we have as a result of that power to know, the storehouse of our experience or our powers to know. And we can think of mind as how we are going to act or think based on that experience. So when you think of how you use that in your everyday life, you can see these three aspects working together at one. You come to a situation, a new person, or a new idea, and you know, you can't get away from that power, that spiritual power of being aware. But along with that awareness is a knowledge of whether this is true or right, comfortable, uncomfortable, there is an accumulated knowledge that comes through our feeling or our physical awareness, even as in our everyday lives. So there is the knowing, and then there is the accumulated experience, and then we have to figure out what we're going to say, how we're going to act, what we're going to think in regard to this person. That's the use of the mind. So in everything we do, we use these threefold things together as one. But it requires that vehicle we call buddhi or soul to storehouse that wisdom. And actually, mind and soul, and as we said, spirit, are all one. You can't separate them.
Yes.
During the second talk, ego is used and ego is used. And we believe they're spelled the same way, E-G-O. Now, isn't there a huge distinction between the two terms? We believe that, we'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Well, we'll start with this way. In the first presentation, it was spoken of that the lower mind is necessary to develop through association of ideas an understanding of who and what we are, but that may not be what we really are. So that is egotism. That is egotism. In other words, the power of the mind can associate ideas. And so when we wake up in the morning, we have an understanding of ourselves. We say, this is my name. This is my family. This is what I do for a living. This is what time I have to get there. This is what I have to do for my work or for school. This is what I like to eat. This is what clothes I want to wear. In other words, we have this construct of who and what we are. We call our personality or our personal idea of self. That's egotism, or the ego, as defined by psychology. But that ego can disintegrate, or can be changed, or can be lost sight of. Think of the person who has amnesia, has an accident, and they don't remember who they are, they don't remember who you are, or the person who has Alzheimer's disease and doesn't even remember their own name, or the name, or who what somebody is. But nevertheless, even with the person who has amnesia, they may have lost the memory or association of ideas to know who or what they are as egos, but that they still have that awareness of I am, or that basic awareness of egoism. So that comes, that immortal faculty of knowing that we are the observer, or egoism, comes from the higher mind. As opposed to this more limited aspect of who we are, which is our ego. So our idea of who and what we are changes from life to life as we incarnate, first in this race, in that nation, in that sex, or this sex, in this circumstance. The associative ideas of who we are changes from life to life, and it's important we gain experience from that. But the ego, ourselves as witnesses, as experiencers, as knowers, as sufferers, as enjoyers, that's the same immortal individuality throughout all those experiences. It is the one actor that performs many roles on many stages in many different performances.
We would like to add one thing to that. The word ego, when you see it in theosophy, is typically capital E-G-O, and it's a synonym for the immortal nature of the human being. The word ego, unfortunately, in the 19-whenevers, was taken by Freud and said, well, we're going to make this the lower nature. And really, that was not the definition of the word. So typically, in theosophy, we don't use the word ego because of the confusion. We would use the word lower nature, the lower self, et cetera, et cetera. Yes?
We're thinking of navigating Columbus and his... fleet sailed in the direction they had set. But they often got lost. In fact, they left it because they were lost. How can you compare this to navigating a ship in an area that you're not familiar with?
Sure. So if we consider the idea of, a ship lost at sea, chances are it's because the person who knows how to guide it is either gone or just not doing his job. Well, what is the knowledge that he uses? Well, there are certain fixed points in the sky that he can use to judge his position on earth, regardless of how windy the wind is, regardless how rough the waves are, regardless of the current of the ocean. He can always know where he is based on those fixed points. Well, similarly, if we live our lives, if we prove to ourselves that there are certain ideas that are always true, and hold to those ideas, no matter how hard the wind blows, then we can know that in the toughest times of life, you know, don't let go of what you know is to be true. In common parlance, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Just remember to keep, you know, keep guidance based on, you know where the stars are, you know what's important, and you know, if we could use an analogy of a stream, if that stream is getting too rough, hold on to the rock, because that's the fixed point until you're able to navigate the stream a little more.
So to develop that analogy, we might say the navigation on the ocean is really based on the same idea of how we navigate ourselves through life. We navigate ourselves through an awareness of what is true, what is changeless. And so as we're navigating through the ocean, there are two fixed, unchanging points that the sailor uses to be able to chart and identify where they are in relationship to the globe. One is the fixed point of the horizon, and the other is either the fixed location of the stars or where the sun is at that point. And so using those reference points and calculations, they can know where they are. But they're, as was stated, they're using certain things that are not changing from year to year, from month to month. They can be relied upon. And so we navigate ourselves through life with the same thing. But instead of our fixed horizon, which is limited, is what we understand in ourselves to be true. Okay, so if we can understand that there is something in ourselves which is unchanging, which we are going to call our higher self, then there must be something in the cosmos at large which is unchanging. We'll call that deity. If there is something in ourselves that knows, that reasons, that is the storehouse of knowledge, and we'll call that mind, then there must be something in the cosmos at large, whether we call stars or suns, that must be the storehouse of wisdom, the guiding intelligence for the operation of the universe. We'll call that universal mind. And if there is something in us that imagines, that sees ideas, that plans according to those ideas, that constructs based on those ideas, what do we call it? Will, then there must be that counterpart in the universe at large, that will, ideation, plan, what Plato called the world of ideas or ideation in the cosmos at large. So we navigate ourselves, we know truth in the world around us by what we see in ourselves to be unchanging. And we get to understand what is true in ourselves and is unchanging, but is by understanding what is true in the world around us. So if we see cycles in the world around us, in every department of nature, it becomes a self-realizing truth to us that we ourselves must be made of cycles. Cyclic law works within ourselves too, in our mind, in our bodies, in our desire nature. So that's how we find the truth, through all the different ideas that come to us, what this person says and that person says. We rely on what is unchanging in ourselves and what is unchanging and truthful around us.
Yes. Yeah.
The premise that I think that is being spoken about is
we have to, like the ship, we have to gain control of it so we cannot fall asleep at the navigation. Well, it's the Gita talks about it as well, that we have to be single-minded and that we have to be focused on what we are doing and who we are. Now, keep on hearing, we're not these bodies. But do our emotions, do they come from the body? Or do they arise from the mind? And you know, where does all this come from? Is it coming from me? Or is it something that exists?
Well, okay, with respect to all of this stuff around our one-centered mind, you know, why is it there? Where's it coming from? Well, it's there because we've created it. We've created it in the sense that we are our own parent. While on the physical plane, of course, everyone has a mother and a father. On inner planes, everything that synthesizes to make up this being is the effect of how we have thought, acted, and felt in previous lifetimes. The impression on all the different planes of matter and substance that we've done that in previous lifetimes, and its assimilation into our nature. Now, when it comes to our physical parents, yes, of course we have two physical parents, but at the same time, it's our inner nature that put together the karma and all the causes and effects that resulted in us being born to those two people. Theosophy tells us it's not that we decide I'm going to be the son of Mary and John, but we do decide that in the sense that all of the causes we put in motion, all the choices that we've made, end up in this lifetime, all things considered, this is the best place for the next step of whoever you are. So, this stuff that we find ourselves in, we have our strengths, we have our abilities, we have our limitations, we have our challenges. We're here because of our defects. We're here to make the effort to correct those defects. So in the process of the lower mind, or in the process of us correcting our defects, it requires cooperation from the lower mind. And if the lower mind would rather be the ostrich and stick its head in the sand of our personal desires, it doesn't have to raise. But it certainly causes trouble for everybody around us. It causes troubles for us from day to day and from life to life until such time that the choice is made to take on the work that is required to purify oneself and to merge the lower mind into the higher mind. And in the process of that merging, there's an effect on all life around us. Is that a hand?
So what I'm hearing is that after doing the inner work, we hold on to what we know to be true about ourselves and the outer world. Like, I have this idea that I am love and I am enough. And I have to train my lower mind to hold on to that truth when confronted with all of these projections of, like, this confused nature that I carry. So is that what?
So the example here then is I have these two ideas that I am love and I am enough. And those two ideas I have, according to my understanding, where I am right now, those are my two fixed ideas that I use, that no matter what happens, if I hold to these ideas, I'm going to deal with everything else in its appropriate way. Same idea.
Okay.
So we'd just like to finish. We said we were starting with a disadvantage from the point of view of reason. So we're going to finish with a brief reading from the devotional books because they appeal directly to our intuition. And one of them is the voice of the silence, and the voice of the silence is our spiritual intuition, which is a soundless voice. And as you listen to the reading, you'll hear intuitively all the ideas we've reasoned about today. The mind is the great slayer of the real. Let the disciple slay the slayer. For when to himself his form appears unreal, as do on wakening all the forms he sees in dreams, when he has ceased to hear the many, he may discern the one, the inner sound which kills the outer. Then only, not till then, shall he forsake the region of Asat, the false, to come into the realm of Sat, the true. Before the soul can see, the harmony within must be attained, and fleshly eyes be rendered blind to all illusion. Before the soul can hear, man has to become as deaf to roarings as to whispers, to cries of bellowing elephants as to the silvery buzzing of the golden firefly. Before the soul can comprehend and may remember, she must unto the silent speaker be united, just as the form to which the clay is modeled is first united with the potter's mind. For then the soul will hear and will remember, and then to the inner ear will speak the voice of the silence. Our meeting is adjourned. Thank you.